to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The growth of gambling as a global industry has people everywhere arguing over whether the benefits outweigh the social and economic costs to communities. And determining the answers to those questions is fertile ground for gambling researchers. Recently, a number of international experts met in Banff at a conference hosted by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute to share their experiences. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. It was only a few years ago that if you wanted to visit a casino or play the slot machines, you'd have to take a trip to Las Vegas or Monte Carlo. Today, those gaming opportunities are as close as the local bar or shopping mall. The rise of legal gambling is a phenomenon that is taking the world by storm. And as governments become more and more dependent on gambling revenues to finance their budgets, people are wondering if this is truly in the public good. In the scientific community, Alberta is emerging as a leader in gambling research. Earlier this spring, the Alberta Gaming Research Institute hosted a conference in Banff to discuss more effective ways to analyze the costs and benefits of gambling. The conference was organized by Dr. Rob Williams, a professor with the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge and a principal investigator with the Alberta Gaming Research Institute.
Really to make some progress in this very thorny issue of whether the social costs and benefits, how do they compare to the economic costs and benefits, and overall, is gambling a good or a bad thing for society? That it's an incredibly important issue, we don't have some good answers to that yet. And this conference is really an attempt to sharpen our focus and to improve our methodologies and try to come to some resolution about whether the benefits do outweigh the costs or vice versa.
Why is methodology such an important issue?
It all hinges on methodology that this is, as I stated in my presentation, the most methodologically complex issue in gambling research, because there's so many variables that are involved in economic impacts, let alone the social impacts. And then the biggest problem is the combining of those things. I mean, how do you equate five new jobs created in the industry versus five new bankruptcies created by problem gamblers? I mean, are they equivalent, and how do you balance one versus the other? And so it's these sort of very thorny methodological issues that's made it very difficult to come to any consensus about whether the pros outweigh the cons.
Have you made any progress at this point to be able to say do it this way versus that way?
There's been a couple of people advocating different solutions to that. I've advocated one solution, which is I don't think there ever will be a consensus. Rather, that there is no common metric that you can use for suicides plus job creation or tax revenues versus bankruptcies. It's rather that the only way you can do it is combine all your clear monetary costs into one common monetary metric and then have different indices for bankruptcy percentage increase, suicide percentage increase. And then you have 15 different indices that are your ultimate measure of the costs and benefits. And then it's inherently a subjective judgment how you weigh those. And so that's my approach. One of the other presenters today, Mark Anielski, argues for a genuine progress indicator, which is trying to create a common metric of well-being of society. But there's methodological complexities there. So we're basically positing different approaches and seeing what sort of attention and support we garner from these proposals.
People at this conference are from Korea, Australia, the United Kingdom, the United States, and of course across Canada. Is there one picture that is emerging?
No, because the reality is that the costs and benefits are very jurisdiction specific. That, I'd love to be able to do a socioeconomic cost and benefit analysis of gambling in Nevada because it would take about a half hour to do. Clearly, the economic costs far outweigh the social costs or any economic costs as well, because you have a huge influx of money from tourists leave their money there, and to the extent that social problems are caused, they take their problems home with them. And so Nevada is a jurisdiction where the solution is completely different from Alberta, which is completely different from Korea, which is completely different. You know, Korea, as they were talking about, they only have one domestic casino. And so the local patronage can't patronize their own casinos. And so from a social perspective, that is much more likely to minimize the harms than, say, in Alberta, where we have casinos that are almost exclusively patronized by locals. And so there is no solution. The solution is very jurisdiction-specific. The consensus concerns, we're having a greater consensus this time about the appropriate approaches to trying to come to those decisions for each jurisdiction.
Are there any common themes, though, growing out of this?
As I said, there's no common themes in terms of the results. The common themes tend to be in terms of recognizing that there are inherently more valid methodological approaches. The good thing about this area of research is that the studies are getting better and better in terms of their sophistication and quality. And that's because of conferences like this where we realize, oh, I never thought about measuring that impact or measuring that impact in that way, or that's clearly a better way than it's been done before. And so what is emerging is some common consensus on not all of the main methodological points, but many of the methodological approaches that you need to take to do a good job of this.
How do you take this then and turn it into public policy? Because ultimately it is our civic leaders, our political leaders who have to make the decisions on the results of the methodology, where they go, what's going to happen with them.
Well, that is the ultimate purpose of all this. I mean, it's a fascinating academic exercise. I mean, it's wonderfully complex. And as an academic, I just love the complexity of this area. But the reality is that it's the most pertinent issue from the government's perspective, that the government makes a discrete decision that either allows gambling or it doesn't. And that's largely on the basis of the answer to the question, do the costs outweigh the benefits or vice versa? And so what we're trying to do here is come up with a consensus on methodology so it can be applied to places like Alberta. Like, this province is in dire need of such an analysis. And I think we're coming to a greater consensus about what that approach should be. And now there should be some money potentially available to do such an analysis here. What is being profiled today are results that have occurred in other jurisdictions like Korea, the United States, and Australia this afternoon, which have shaped government policy. Although I'm a bit cynical there as well, because you see some of the results like the U.S. National Gambling Impact Study or the Australian one, and government policy continues despite the results sometimes. And so, but our ultimate hope as researchers is that we do good, clear, objective scientific research which would impact policy around that. That's our intent.
I think the thing that's really come home to me is that the concern over problem and pathological gambling, though, is a very common one, and it's something that everybody is looking at.
That's true, but just to play the devil's advocate, what the industry, what the government, and what researchers would also argue is that there's probably been too much focus on problem pathological gambling, which only constitutes 3 or 4% of the population, that the large majority of the populace gambles, buys lottery tickets or plays bingo or scratch and win, and they do it without problems, and that when you're truly trying to come to some aggregate decision about the leisure benefits or the social economic benefits, you need to take into account the enjoyable and innocuous benefits that this form of entertainment has for the large majority of people. Now, that has to be offset with the enormous social costs incurred by problem gamblers, but you can't focus on one and not the other.
Thank you very much, Rob.
More than welcome.
That was Dr. Rob Williams, a professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge and a principal investigator with the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. He helped organize the recent conference in Banff on the social and economic impacts of gambling. Just as politicians point to the annual GDP as an indicator of economic well-being, perhaps they should also be using another index, one that measures our overall social well-being. That was the message presented by economist Mark Inelski to participants at the recent conference hosted by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute.
Well, we're trying to develop a framework for measuring the well-being impacts of gaming or playing games of chance for Canada, which would set hopefully an international precedent for a framework that researchers and future policy analysts can use to assess what impacts, both positive and negative, that gaming has on Canadians.
Why is it that a framework is necessary?
Well, a framework is necessary because it provides an analytic tool for making trade-offs in terms of is there, in fact, a demonstrated net benefit or net cost of gaming at different scales, the individual scale, at the family, household scale, or the community scale, and looking at all of the benefits, including benefits to industry and employment and taxes and then all the social costs that are sometimes very difficult to get at.
How is it that you're looking at this?
We've done a very massive research, a literature research, and so we're trying to piece all of the good pieces of research together to come up sort of with a taxonomy, sort of a, you know, the top listing of research that would inform a development of a meaningful framework that, and then we can show where the gaps are in terms of data that will direct us to future research.
Now, your background is as an economist, and so you're looking at the money that's going into the gaming. And certainly gaming has become a growth industry in Alberta. You see it going all around the world. What kind of money are we talking about here, just looking at the Alberta example?
Well, for example, last year the gross gaming revenues were $20.6 billion. So that means $20.6 billion was, in effect, coming out of people's genes into VLTs and casinos. That's a staggering amount of money. The oil and gas sales alone last year were $64 billion. And so these are significant. The gaming gross sales are about 10.9% of Alberta's GDP last year. So they're massive in size.
That $20 billion coming from gaming, how does that compare to Alberta's budget?
Well, Alberta's budget, if I recall, last year is around $25, $26 billion. So it is significant in compared. Now, granted that a lot of that $20 billion gets paid out as prizes, about 92% of VLT, for example, sales get paid out as prizes. So you could say, well, the gross profit of the province is about $1.8 billion last year. So it's still significant. It's actually larger than oil sands royalty revenues last year.
Now, those revenues, how are they affecting the well-being of the people who are in the casinos and putting that money out?
Well, we actually don't really know what the impacts are on individuals. I would argue that, you know, we should have a smile index and see how many people actually smile when they're in casinos versus, you know, when they go to Disneyland or other places of entertainment. We don't really know a lot about what people experience in the problem gambling group. And so that's part of the research that needs to be done. I mean, there is some research going on, but more has to be known about all of the ripple effects of that person's choice to gamble and become a pathological or problem gambler.
Well, one of the concerns is that there's a disproportionate amount of money that does come from problem gamblers. I've heard as much as 35-40%.
According to recent research, it's 39%. Of the gaming revenues are coming from problem gamblers. That's the equivalent of $20,000 per problem gambler. So $20,000 per problem gambler is going to the gross profits, which is enormous considering that the average household income of a Calgarian is about $28,000.
That sounds like a huge tax.
Well, you could argue it's gambling is a very impressive, regressive form of taxation. You know, I call it revenue harvesting because it entices people to spend their money on a game of chance that they know, maybe they don't know, that there's a probability of losing. And it's clear that everyone loses. The house always wins. And yet we assume people are rational in economics. But even with the knowledge of those odds, people are still playing and putting their financial and family well-being at risk.
What are the factors that you're looking at then to develop this framework for research based on the factors that you're getting from the amount of money that is going in from different households, various different economic and social values?
Well, I mean, the first sort of cut would be to look at, you know, the revenue, the side where of cash flow. So how much is, you know, contributed by problem gamblers to gaming revenues? How does that relate to the family, the average sort of problem gambler's socioeconomic profile, like their income? And, you know, the typical problem gambler tends to be male, Aboriginal, you know, lower educated. So what does their economic profile look like? And so there's those things. There's things like impacts on bankruptcy rates and suicide. And so there's a bunch of social costs, like, you know, breakdown of relationships and community impacts, that all need to be sort of categorized. Very difficult. There are a lot of data gaps. There's clearly going to be, you know, a lot of research that's needed to fill those gaps. But what we try to do is basically draw a blueprint. And it's kind of like drawing a blueprint for a house and figure out how many rooms can we build with data that we've got and how many rooms still need work to complete the house.
You've just finished your presentation. What would you say is the take-home message?
I think the take-home message is that if we're going to look at gambling, we need to look at it from the perspective of real economics, which is looking at the impacts on well-being, the net well-being impacts at both the individual household level and at the community level, and really ask ourselves, is gambling the best public policy choice we have, in particular in terms of fiscal policy? Is it the best choice? Because if it's not, if there's an alternative, for example, raising oil sands royalties to offset these gambling revenues, is that maybe a better choice, a less regressive choice that has less negative impacts on well-being overall for Albertans? That's the message I'd like to leave people with.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
That was economist Mark Inelski, president of Inelski Management, Inc. He spoke about weighing the social and economic impacts of gambling at the recent conference in Banff hosted by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. Gambling scientists are wrestling with the issue of methodology. How can researchers develop studies that allow for better interpretation of their results? This was the topic of great discussion at a recent conference sponsored by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute in Banff. And according to keynote speaker Dr. Eric Singel, gambling researchers may benefit from the lessons learned by those working in the area of substance abuse. Eric Singel is a professor of public health sciences at the University of Toronto, and he is the scientific advisor emeritus with the Canadian Centre on Substance Abuse.
I suppose it's that we've had some experience now in an ongoing process of developing international guidelines for doing studies estimating the cost of substance abuse, and that experience has maybe some lessons for the development of similar guidelines for estimating the cost of gambling, costs and benefits of gambling.
What would be those similarities or those lessons?
Well, one is you have to use multidisciplinary teams because these are very complex issues that involve not just economics by any means, but epidemiology, criminology, public health, people with familiarity with reporting systems and the treatment system. You need a team of people. It can't be done adequately by one person alone or even a group of if they're all from one discipline. The other thing is not to expect too much. The really important thing here isn't the bottom line. The bottom line estimates, I don't even believe in my own studies the bottom line estimates so much. I know there's so much variability in things. So you have to do lots and lots of sensitivity analysis. What if you did a different assumption here, a different assumption there? Every study should have four or five sensitivity analyses attached to it in order to compare it to other studies. And I guess the major focus should be that you need to have see this not as an exercise in getting a bunch of experts who are going to write a cookbook about how to do it. You know, start at step one and then you add this and then do that. It's not going to be that way at all, not for a long time at least. It's going to be a process that might take a generation of gradually refining the guidelines through experience and actually applying them in studies and, you know, learning about new mythological issues or problems or new consequences, positive or negative, that emerge and so forth. And it has to be an international, sort of a consensual process. So it's going to take a long time. I see this meeting has the potential of being the first step in that process. With regard to substance abuse, we've made, you know, a huge amount of progress. I wouldn't have thought possible just 10 years ago when we first met here in Banff, ironically. You know, studies were all over the map, the widely varying estimates, because nobody was using the same framework. They were all over the map. And even though we don't really have a cookbook, it's more laying out of the issues, and here are your options. And if you, whatever you choose, try to report it in a way that it makes it comparable to a study that might have been done by someone else using a different option, using sensitivity analysis or whatever. So it's that kind of a thing. It's a starting point. The way that the concept of GDP started, you know, a generation ago or more than a generation ago now. Now it's a very useful tool in economic analysis, even though I agree with Ilyadsky's points that it doesn't cover the whole of social well-being by any means. It's still, you know, initially it was subject to all kinds of criticisms. A lot of people came to the conclusion like it was an impossible thing to do. But they were proven wrong. I mean, it has, even Chad has GDP, which is reasonably robust. So I'm hoping that this will go the same way a generation from now. It won't be even in 10 years, but a generation from now we'll have a well-established, agreed-upon methodology that everyone can use.
When you look at that, do you get any indications as to how entrenched not just substance abuse, but now gambling has become to our overall economy and the way we live?
Terribly entrenched. I mean, you know, the argument's often been made that it's governments themselves are more addicted to gambling than anybody else because of the revenue that they come from. And I think we're just beginning to see the magnitude of some of the problems associated with that. At the individual level in terms of problem gambling and pathological gambling, and at community level. But I also think that a large part of the gambling research literature has failed to take into account, it's early, I'm not criticizing the people here, but you know, what may be the major consequence, the major adverse consequences of legalized gambling, I think, is its impact on the distribution of wealth in society. It's not that it creates some pathological and problem gamblers. That is a real problem, an important part of the problem. But I think an equally important part, which is really not studied well at all, is what happens when all gambling represents a regressive tax. Some of them are incredibly regressive, like lotteries. Lotteries basically take a little bit of money from a lot of people and create a few millionaires. And it's disproportionately taking money from poor people because that's the only chance they'll ever have in their lives of becoming millionaires. So it's not just everybody equal tax. It's what they call the so-called voluntary tax. And what I really dislike is it's making us more like American society. The difference between rich and poor is growing rapidly. And legalized gambling is very much accelerating that process. And that's, to me, a key difference between American Canadian society is the difference between the rich and poor and the social welfare net that we have here that they don't have in the States. And the more a sense of civic culture, they don't have a concept of civic culture down there. It's all, everybody's out for themselves. And it's a more dog-eat-dog world. And I think our higher quality of life, which we clearly have in terms of UN indices and other things, I think in large part stems from the fact that we have more social equality.
In your presentation, you made a comment about the comparison between illegal gambling and legal gambling. What's better?
Well, yeah, almost universally, when proposals have been made to introduce legalized gambling, it's often done, one of the major rationales tends to be that it's going to replace illegal gambling, as if illegal gambling is much worse for the public than legal gambling possibly could be. And in fact, most of the gambling that is replaced by these new legalized gambling opportunities is not illegal so much as social gambling. Things like a bunch of friends getting together playing poker or betting on sporting events, whatever it might be. And in those situations, it's not at all obvious that opening casinos and providing legal gambling opportunities is going to be an improvement over that situation. In the social gambling, there are 101 informal mechanisms by which people can reduce the harm that might come from excessive gambling. And their friends do it, too. I mean, I've been in poker games where probably most people have been in poker games where who play poker, at least, where They've seen, you know, someone wants to borrow money. They've lost more than they came with, and people stop loaning the money because they've lost enough. Or someone who's winning has a good hand, but he doesn't pound someone. He doesn't take advantage of it against someone who's losing. That sort of thing happens all the time in social games. There's a lot of mechanisms that prevent the damage from getting to be too bad for a bad gambler. By contrast, you go to a casino in Ontario today, you can mortgage your house 24 hours a day or 7 days a week. It's the only place in the province where you can do that. Now, where is the government responsibility here, you know, to do that sort of thing? It's, you know, the behavior of the gaming industry itself has a lot to do with whether or not it really is preferred over quote-unquote illegal gambling. I think in a lot of ways, quasi-legal or illegal gambling is probably better for the public than is the legal gambling, especially when you take into account the great increase in volume in gambling that occurs.
This conference is about the socioeconomic impacts and benefits and the negative aspects of what we see coming out of this gambling culture that we're creating now. What would you see then as being good research in the setting up of research on these socioeconomic impacts?
The speakers this morning I thought were excellent. I mean, you know, and I didn't always feel that way about some of them. But like Mark Eliansky's concept of well-being rather than simply economic outputs in dollar terms is crucial to really getting at these issues. It's an excellent start, I think, you know, to look at something like more than just employment and revenue and arguing about whether you should count this and not count that. He's looking at the whole well-being in the community. And that's where we should go. That's very consistent with current trends in public health, you know, where we no longer look so much at, we don't think of health as the absence of disease. We think of it as a whole lifestyle, a whole, you know, a whole sense of well-being.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Dr. Eric Singel, a professor of public health sciences at the University of Toronto and the scientific advisor emeritus with the Canadian Centre on Substance Abuse. He spoke at the recent conference on the social and economic impacts of gambling, hosted by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. I also spoke with Dr. Rob Williams and economist Mark Anelski. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Innovation and Science, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Conservation Association, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, Calgary Technologies, Inc., Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.